And good evening, good morning, good afternoon, whatever time it is where you are. This is Tom Harris in beautiful Chicago, Illinois, and welcome to Tom Harris USA, episode number 67. And it's a bit warm, actually, the last few days here in Chicago. And when I say warm, I mean relatively speaking, of course. You still need a heavy coat to go outside. But it has actually been raining for the last couple of days, and temperatures in the 40s. And after the cold weather that we've had, it seems to be, you know, rather much warmer. And it has actually been quite pleasant out when it's not raining. So it's been a pretty interesting week. Pretty much all of the snow is gone. Another chock full week as far as things going on in my personal life. And for the most part, this is pretty good news coming out. The biggest news is that I am now officially re-employed. Now, interestingly enough, when I first lost my job, if you guys recall, I was talking about how normally it takes me about 2 months to find new employment after leaving a job. And in this economy, I was expecting it to take 3 months. And I was pretty close. It was a little bit longer than 3 months, but just by a couple of weeks. So that's not too bad at all. Now, this is, of course, at my prior employer, like I said before. And I know that I had talked a little bit about this last time. I talked about how, you know, the woman who had replaced me at my previous job had left. And they were turning to me for help. And they wanted me to come in and help them out and kind of come back on a provisional basis for a while. That seems to have gone by the wayside now. They have now actually hired me back. However, it is a four-month contract. So I will be there for 4 months. At least. And of course, at the end of that contract, it'll remain to be seen whether they want to, you know, extend the contract or whether or not they want to just, you know, have me full time again back as full employment. Now, the good thing about this arrangement is that it doesn't require me to, you know, tell white lies to the unemployment board. And we were kind of, you know, mulling over saying, should we do this under the table so I could keep looking for work? And I guess they decided they really didn't want me to continue to job hunt and still help out. So they made me this new offer. And it's an acceptable offer. It's not the most fantastic offer in the world, but it's good. Essentially, they're going to treat this as though I never left. I'm coming back in with my full benefits. I'm coming back in with, my house charge and I'm coming back in with the same salary, all the perks. The conditions are exactly the same as when I left. I was telling my supervisor that they should just consider it my maternity leave and leave it at that. So at the end of 4 months, they'll reassess and we'll decide whether they still need me or not. But for the moment, I am back. And that's that. And this is the end of my first full week back at work, so that's been exciting. It has been kind of a rough adjustment, getting back in and getting up early every day and taking the train up and working all day and then coming back and trying to think of things to talk about on the show. But it is, the first few days were very weird. And it felt very weird to be back in the office. Now, I didn't get my old desk back because my old desk is actually gone. One of the restaurants came and they needed it for their manager's office. So my desk is gone. I'm set up in a new part of the office, which I'm not used to. And I'm just kind of just now, after the end of my first week, starting to get this arranged in something of a way that will allow me to operate more efficiently, because the way it was when I first got there was a complete and utter disaster. So this has been quite an adjustment, and they got way behind on work during the time when I was not there. So that has been my task for most of this week, is to try to get caught up and so forth. And of course they have end of the year stuff that they're doing now too. So that makes it more exciting. Now I will say though, now this is probably the last I'm going to be talking about my job, because as I mentioned in one of the earlier episodes, and I think it was the episode nearest to the time when I actually lost my job. Because all of the conditions of my previous employment are now being enforced again, one of the things that is being enforced again is the agreement that I signed, the non-disclosure agreement. So I can't talk about my job. So I'm not going to give any specifics, of course, on what's going on other than to say that I'm back doing the same kind of work under the same benefits, pay, conditions, etc. So that's good. I suppose I can let you know again after the 4 months is up or my contract expires or whatever happens that, for now at least, things are back to normal, which is nice because, being on unemployment kind of stinks. Even though it is, money, and even though it allowed me to pay the basic bills, I wasn't going out and spending a lot of money. I was being very parsimonious in how I would dole out the cash for things. But now I can kind of relax a little bit. I can start thinking about vacation again, because I have two vacations this year that I'm planning. One to Florida, which is going to be in June and will probably just be for a weekend, for my 30th high school reunion. And the other one is my family reunion in Minnesota, and that'll be in August. So I'm going to start planning once again for those vacations, and because the 4 month contract, even if I lose my job at the end of that, would be up in June. So that would be up in June, and then I would be going, in the middle of August, and I might even take that month, off and go on vacation before I would go to the reunion. And I did that actually when I lost my last job 3 years ago. And did exactly that. I took the summer off and then I went on vacation. And then when I came back, I started looking for work. So we'll see how that goes. But it is nice to have income again and to not worry so much about whether or not I'll be able to pay my bills. But it really isn't so bad. I've never been one of these people that's needed a lot in life. And I was talking about this the other day actually with Scott Mitchell from the Scott Podcast and one of the voice files that we swap back and forth. And I was talking about how I don't get certain aspects of suburban life. And even though I was raised in kind of a semi-suburban environment, and I have a lot of members of my family who actually do live in that sort of suburban life, but there's a lot of aspects of that I really don't get. It's kind of a weird world of suburbia and shopping malls and fast food joints and soccer games and sort of conspicuous consumerism. And one of those things that I really don't get is the need that some people feel to keep acquiring things, to surround yourself with stuff. Now, and I've often said, and occasionally joked about, I live in a studio apartment, which is essentially one main room, a walk-in closet, a bathroom, and a kitchen. So it's not a very big place at all. It's a little bit bigger than the dorm room that I lived in Ohio when I was living on Ohio University campus. Actually, it's much bigger actually, but it's still a very small space as far as apartments go. And essentially all of my business here is carried out in one room. I do the podcast, I sleep, I watch DVDs, I play computer games, I everything basically is done in this one living slash bedroom. And so it is kind of a tiny little apartment. But really it's all that I feel I need. The thing is, and maybe this is kind of a conditioning that has happened over the last few years, but my tendency has been to want to be rid of things and not get more things. So it seems like whenever I get something, I try to get rid of something and try to maintain some sort of equilibrium of stuff. And I could live quite happily with very, very little. During the time I was growing up, I grew up in a house with a pack rat. My mom is a pack rat. My aunts and uncles are pack rats. And I think that my siblings are to some extent pack rats as well. And it's something that I grew up in and really thought of it as being normal. And it's only been in the last 10 years or so, maybe a little longer than that now, that I've started to really, really break myself of that. And I don't want to acquire stuff, you know, and I don't get it when people, that's all they care about. To have the latest gadget, to have the latest computer, to have the latest car, to have the latest furniture, a swimming pool. And then you want a bigger house and a bigger car and a bigger TV and everything needs to be bigger and better and more conspicuous and assemble this kingdom of junk around you. It is very strange. And I really wonder how sustainable this is. And is this why we're having so much problems financially in this country? Is this why so many people have this enormous credit card debt? Is this why so many people, you know, find themselves, you know, with these empty lives? They're putting so much concentration on acquiring material goods that they're kind of allowing that to consume their entire life. And I'm not some sort of a Luddite or a back-to-nature freak. You know, I'm not one of these people who, you know, would go off and live in a cave with no electricity and so forth. I like my creature comforts, too. I don't have a cell phone, but that's because I don't need one. I don't have a television, but that's because I don't want one. I mean, I lived in that sort of a world. I mean, I grew up in that sort of a world. Now, we didn't have a lot of money when I was growing up, so we didn't ever really have the latest and greatest of everything. You know, but I do look around and I see so many people engaged in this sort of behavior. And whenever I go visit relatives or friends who live in suburbs and sort of live that way, it just seems very foreign to me. It's like being in a foreign country. Now, I'm pretty comfortable in foreign countries. I don't usually, but this is a foreign country that really feels alien. And it really makes me uncomfortable in a way. To be confronted with this constantly. So this weird idea, and I've seen this in my own family, and I've seen this among relatives especially, that they have these weird obsessions with things. And some of those weird obsessions would be things like obsessing about furniture, you know, and redecorating. They're constantly redecorating. And acquiring things, acquiring gadgets, and I'm sure we all know people who are like that. But I've never been really like that. And maybe part of that is having grown up in an environment where we couldn't afford that. At the same time, there was a time in my life when I lived like that. Or at least I made the attempt, because that was kind of how I was raised to think of it as being a normal sort of American dream kind of life. You know, you want to have the house. You want to have the two cars. You want to have the 2.5 kids. You want to have the pets. You want to have, you know, all these toys surrounding you. And, you know, there was a time in my life when I did actually have a house and have two cars and sort of have this sort of existence. But I found it strangely empty. It didn't make me happy. It wasn't satisfying for me. And I find the way that I live right now and kind of the way that I've lived ever since, I moved back to Ohio as being a lot more satisfying and maybe simpler. And maybe simplicity is just the sort of thing that appeals to me. At the same time, at certain times in my life, I've really been absorbed into a collector's mentality. Was a comic book collector for many years, not really much anymore. But I do occasionally, you know, pick up things, you know, books mainly. But when people try to give me things, I'm usually saying, oh, no, thanks. I really don't need that. And especially during the time when my mom and her husband were moving around and they would be constantly offering me furniture. And it's like, really, honestly, Mom, I really don't want that. You know, because I have no place to put it, first of all. And second of all, I don't need to be acquiring more stuff. You know, I had some women a couple years ago, well, it's quite a few years ago now, about 7 years ago now, they tried to give me a television. And I'd say, no, I really don't want one. I really don't like, you know, I'm not a TV watcher. I won't get much use out of it. Don't worry, you know. And so I convinced them not to give it to me in the long run. And that, of course, hasn't changed. I still don't want a TV, even if somebody wants to give me one for free. But I, you know, if anything, I'd actually like to reduce the amount of stuff in my life. I would really like to be rid of, for example, my comic book collection, which is something that has been many years in the making, and I haven't really had the time even when I was unemployed, I really didn't have the time to try to sell it because it, you know, it's a really tough market for, you know, this large accumulation of comics. It's not something that, you know, a lot of people are going to want to invest, you know, $10,000 or so in a comic book collection. The collectability of back issues is way down. I mean, the publishers are reprinting a lot of these old books. And people can buy them cheaper in trade paperback than they would to buy the original. So, that, of course, the pool of people who would actually want to buy these original issues is going down. So the value is going down. And I really don't care that much about the overall value of the collection. I think the first reasonable offer would be likely to take it. And when I say reasonable offer, I mean, you know, probably the first reasonable offer over $10,000. Because it's worth much, much more than that. And maybe this is a weird obsession of my own, and maybe I just come from a family of obsessives, which is probably true, but mostly pretty nice obsessives. But anyway, what I would like to really do is to make my life portable and just have enough stuff in my life just to do the basic things. You know, I would need a computer. I would need stuff like dishes, sheets and towels, you know, some sort of, you know, way to get online, you know, something to listen to music on, you know, some basic furniture, my bed, maybe my couch. Of course, my couch is kind of ratty and I do want to get rid of it. You know, just sort of the very basic level of stuff. And I was saying to Scott, you know, just enough maybe to fit it in a U-Haul trailer and be extremely portable in that sense of being able to, just kind of move on a moment's notice, become more nomadic maybe, travel more and not have a lot of stuff around, you know, and just keep the essentials like my boyfriend, because of course he's a good one and I don't want to let him go. That's something that I'd like to strive for, is portability in my life. But, of course, one of the biggest things that actually keeps me from doing that, of course, is the comic book collection. And I doubt very much that I'm going to be able to find somebody who would want to invest in that. And if anybody out there knows somebody who would, please let me know. The email address for the show, if you want to get in contact with me, is tom@tomharrisusa.com. I always love hearing from people, and I always love to hear what people have to say. And I do have an email here this week. This is from our good friend Leanne. Thanks, Leanne, for writing in. And she had this to say about episode number 66. Tom, so very sorry to hear about the loss of your friend, Mr. Tippett. I had seen your Facebook post, but was hesitant to ask. No doubt he would appreciate the honest, real, and honorable way you spoke of him on your program. He must have been quite the character. Yeah, he was. I think that his presence will be missed. And like I said on the previous show, you know, he was not a big part of my life. He wasn't somebody who I would see every week or even every month. It was somebody who, you know, I would encounter once in a while. Now, his boyfriend, my friend Denny, I speak to rather more often, and Denny and I meet fairly often for coffee. And right now I'm more concerned about him, obviously, because, you know, Dick is gone and he's not suffering anymore. And I think Denny is in more need of support right now, but he seems to be managing pretty well. I think that he has a little bit of time to prepare for the loss, and from what I can see, he's been dealing with it pretty well. Now, I do know that he is planning on going away in a couple of weeks, and I'm going to come and feed his cats for him while he's gone, because he is going to go and celebrate his birthday with his family in Toledo, and that'll be the first time in, I think, in many years that he's gone to Toledo for his birthday, because quite often it would be a very simple affair, and that I would sometimes join them for dinner on Denny's birthday. So I'm more concerned about Denny at the moment, but he does, like I said, he does seem to be managing pretty well. So anyway, thanks for Leanne. And Leanne also sent a link to a website. Now, this is interesting. And this is arizonacentral.com, azcentral.com. They have an article on graffiti, because I had talked about having this fascination with graffiti. and they have found some purported graffiti that is supposed to possibly be from the 16th century. And this is a writing on an Iraq in Arizona, apparently not too far from Phoenix, in the Salt River Valley, along the Arizona-Mexico border, the area, sort of right in there. And it is supposedly the friar Marcos de Niza, who actually was traveling through the territory that is now New Mexico and Arizona, all the way to the coast, and apparently this, people are claiming that this inscription that was made in the rock was made by Father Marcos de Niza. But it does seem doubtful. They had originally had enclosed this etching in a steel cage so that people couldn't disturb it. But the guy who's investigating it, it's a guy called Ron Dorn, thinks that it is a 20th century piece of graffiti. So we'll find out, I guess, and hopefully, you know, Leanne will keep me posted on the story, because this isn't a news site that I look at. But, you know, it's interesting. I was talking about graffiti before, and I talked about Roman graffiti because I thought that was probably among the most interesting, even though I don't speak Latin, even though I can only get a very vague idea of what the graffiti was. But there was a lengthy piece of graffiti, and I talked about this, at the tomb of Diocletian, which is in Split, Croatia. And Split used to be the site of Diocletian's palace, and it was right on the ocean. There's a harbor, you know, Split Harbor, and then there, you know, Diocletian built a palace complex, and it was surrounded by a wall, and then they had the temple where Diocletian was buried, because of course many of the Roman emperors were revered as deities. And the Christians came by later, and they took Diocletian's bones and threw them into the ocean, because Diocletian, you know, didn't have any particular fondness for Christians. And they turned his tomb into a church. And very interesting, obviously Roman design, and it's been pretty well preserved. Now, the rest of the city, the rest of the Roman palace complex is basically gone, because what had happened was they had torn down all the buildings within the wall, but they left the wall standing. Interestingly enough, the Roman wall surrounding the palace complex was still standing, and some of the buildings were still standing. And over time, the Venetians, the Venetians controlled that area of Croatia for a long time, and they built more buildings inside those walls. It's basically the city center of Split is this really cramped shopping district, very medieval shopping district. All the buildings are really close together, and it all fits inside this old Roman wall. And it's really kind of an interesting place. But anyway, I was getting way off the track here. It was up in the tower of the cathedral, the tomb. There is a piece of graffiti that was written in, I think it was 1719, and it's a whole paragraph in Italian. Yeah, this was during the time when the Venetians were probably not quite in control anymore, but there was a very strong Italian influence there. And they wrote this entire big paragraph on the wall that scraped it into the bricks. And it's kind of cool, really, to see, you know, graffiti that old. And I've seen other examples of this too. But this was by far probably the most impressive of the old graffiti that I'd seen. And even if it wasn't as old as all that, I mean, there's certainly, you know, down in the catacombs of Rome, there was graffiti that was carved into the walls by Christian sects who would bury their dead down in the catacombs. And this would have still been during Roman times and immediately thereafter, after the fall of Rome. And, they had their secret codes that were, you know, that's where we get the Jesus fish, for example. Because of the supposed persecution of Christians under the Roman Empire, which has been highly overstated, I might add. But it was interesting, and I love seeing that stuff. And it's too bad that, you know, we don't live in a country really that has that much history. So something like this supposed etching on, you know, in Arizona near Phoenix, would be something really cool if it turned out to be true. And there's certainly a lot of graffiti out west that was carved by various explorers that went that way. Lewis and Clark left graffiti in some of the places that they were. The French would leave, you know, graffiti carved in boulders and things like that. So it is kind of interesting. And like I said, I have this sort of fascination with graffiti. And not even always just with ancient graffiti, because I've seen a lot of, like, urban graffiti that is really interesting to me, you know, the design aspect of it. Some of it is quite extraordinary from a design perspective. Now, you know, I'm not talking about the gang tags. Like, we see around here a lot of these scribbles, which are, they're initials, you know, the spray paint, but they're not very exciting. It's somebody, you know, putting their mark on something, and there's nothing much artistic about it. But I remember in Cleveland watching out the window of the train when I'd go downtown, and the bed that the rapid transit track ran on, it was an old Union Pacific train bed, or, you know, something like that. It was real trains that used to go through there. And there were these embankments, concrete embankments up either side. And the people would get down in there, and they still do, I'm sure, even though they have fences and things to keep them out. And they would do these really elaborate, colorful graffiti art down there. And sure, it's vandalism, but down in a place like that, it doesn't hurt anything, you know. It's not really harming anyone, and some of it is artistically very, very good. And you kind of wonder why these people don't go off and make a career in the art world, you know, doing something a little bit less, you know, destructive, I guess you could say. And I know there are, you know, I am familiar with some artists who came into the art world from doing graffiti. So you know, nobody needs to send me any links about that. I've seen them. The famous graffiti artists, you know, people like Keith Haring, you know, everybody knows Keith Haring, you know, on site. They might not know that it's Keith Haring who did it, but you recognize his, you know, his barking dogs and babies and things that he did in this very simplistic style. Jean-Michel Basquiat, who is also got his start doing, you know, graffiti art. And even, you know, people like Banksy, the famous British graffiti artist who is quite well known around the world. So there definitely is a crossover between the sort of guerrilla underground art movement and fine art. And I think that, you know, nowadays, you know, people don't regard, you know, the late Keith Haring as a vandal. I mean, they would think of it as being, you know, a fine artist, and there's actually merchandising that, you know, with his art on it. So, you know, in a lot of ways, graffiti is very much a part of the modern art world. When I was a student at Ohio University, we had a professor there who did these very elaborate murals, which you know, it's not, I wouldn't call it graffiti exactly, but it was based in that sensibility. And the artist's name is Ethelred Eldritch. And he's an art professor at Ohio University who's been there for eons. I mean, since before I was born. And, just is this insane character. And everybody at OU knows Ethelred Eldritch. So I'm not really sure how well known he is outside of Athens, Ohio. I mean, I think that maybe his fan base, or the people who are really familiar with him, are really all people who are connected with OU, since he's been there for so long. But getting back to graffiti artists for a moment, you know, the actual street artists, you kind of wonder, you know, all this talent that's kind of wasted by that. You know what I'm saying? Anyway, thank you, Leanne, for your email and for allowing me to go off on a very long tangent. And I'm running out of time, so I'm going to go ahead and sign off for now. Thanks for listening. As always, the email address, if you want to participate in the program, is tom@tomharrisusa.com. So from Chicago, Illinois, this is Tom Harris signing off. We'll see you next time.